Tuesday, July 1st. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCory in for Avi Wolf-Manarin.
So today we're going to talk about President Donald Trump's big, beautiful bill. That's what he calls it. Right now, the 940-page Senate package is being voted on as we speak, or about to be. We just have breaking news. It was just voted on, and Vice President J.D. Vance has broken the tie. So it was 50-50, and the vice president broke the tie.
So the bill passes, and now we'll go back
51,
to the House.
Yeah, 51 to 50.
Be negotiated again in the House.
So yeah, we'll be talking about that. The 940-page bill has passed the U.S. Senate, enshrining permanent tax cuts, border and military funding, and sweeping cuts to Medicaid, SNAP, and clean energy incentives. And all of this will now be debated in the U.S. House. So there could be some big potential impacts, and the biggest of which that everyone is talking about and worried about is to possibly Medicaid. So we'll dig into that. We have several guests that are going to come in and help us parse through what's in the bill, what could be the sticking points in the U.S. House going forward. And we want to get your thoughts and invite you to join the conversation today. Our question of the day is this: how do you think the president's spending bill will affect you? If it passes the U.S. House, what impact do you think it will have for the country? Our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you are watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your questions or comments in the chat. And by the way, the Senate has passed the GOP domestic policy bill carrying President Trump's agenda 51 to 50, just to be clear, with Vice President J.D. Vance casting the tie-breaking vote. Three Republicans, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, and Rand Paul of Kentucky voted against.
So we're right on the breaking news here, Cherry.
Yeah.
And, you know, it shows that this domestic policy agenda by Trump has real legs. It's now going to go back to the House, and we'll see if it can get final passage there. But this is what the Trump administration is spending its political capital on, and we'll sort through what that means for the country and what that means for politics, et cetera.
So much to talk about. So much to talk about. Again, the number is 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. And I really do hope that you will call in and offer your perspectives. This is what the show is really about, being a sounding board for our region. And so we hope to hear from
you. So before we get to that conversation, we always do a trio of local news stories to keep you abreast of everything happening in the Philadelphia region.
And well, there's a lot.
Big news today, of course, was Philadelphia's Blue Collar Workers Union is on strike for the first time in 40 years. Mm. The leader of District Council 33 called for an immediate work stoppage after negotiations with the city fell apart late last night. So this union consists of more than 9,000 city workers. That's people in sanitation, the streets department, LNI, 911 dispatch,
crossing guards,
recreation centers, the Philadelphia Water Department. The key dispute here, as often in these negotiations, is salary and health benefits. Mm-hmm. So union members currently make an average of $46,000 a year. The Inquirer is reporting that the final back and forth negotiations last night was the union saying they wanted 5% raises annually over 4 years, and Parker saying she could do a 3-year deal with up to 3% annual raises. So they were farther apart, even when we talked about this yesterday. They're getting closer, but they still didn't get close enough to make a deal. And now, there's a work stoppage, which means city is reassigning other workers to key roles because Parker's saying this won't threaten public safety and, you know, key facets of government will continue operating. But curbside trash is suspended. There are these 63 temporary drop-off sites across the city that the city has set up for people to bring their trash to. And then there's these sanitation convenience centers, which always exist. They're still there. And we should note the last time this really happened and affected trash was 1986. Mm-hmm. It was a 20-day strike in 1986 where the trash was piling up. And now we're bracing for the 4th of July holiday, which always brings a ton of garbage to the parkway. Mm-hmm. So we have to see what's going to happen.
And people don't realize, I know people who work in the sanitation department, and let me tell you, they work really hard. They do a tough job, especially in the heat. And people realize they throw their trash out. You don't think the trash bags open up sometimes. You get nasty. You have to pick things up. And so I think once people's trash stops getting picked up, people will feel it. It will hurt us all the longer this strike continues. By the way, if you follow me on Facebook, you know I post questions every day. The sentiments were a variety. Some said pay them. This is a hard job. Others said 8% a year. That's a lot, but it's come down to 5%. Wonder what people feel about that. So, you know, I don't envy the mayor. She has a really tough job of balancing the city budget, mm-hmm. but she also has to make sure workers, especially in this department, are well taken care of because cleanest and greenest, her top priority.
And you're going to have contracts coming up for the police department, for the fire department.
For the teachers.
And the, you know, all of that.
All of that.
So there's a lot of competing priorities on the city of Philadelphia. And that's part of doing business in the city of Philadelphia.
It is. And since we're talking about money, got to talk about SEPTA for our second story. SEPTA has been in a money crunch as it faces a more than $200 million fiscal cliff. But they have stepped up. And they have cracked down on one area, and that is fare evasion. The Philadelphia Inquirer did a very thorough piece on the transit agency's stepped up efforts. This year alone, they have criminally charged 3,200 people with fare evasion, a huge jump up from just 312 during the same period last year. 3,200 just this year. Last year, during the same time period, 312.
It shows they just really weren't enforcing.
Oh, they were not playing. And you know, SEPTA began the crackdown last summer, and it tapered off during the winter. And then they got really serious in March, where they were dealing with about 50-plus cases a day. And in the year since the effort began, SEPTA has charged about 7,400 people with this summary offense. And fare evaders were costing SEPTA about $50 million a year. Yeah. And, you know, they have had a lot of pushback in Harrisburg, Kevin, where they've been told, look, you want more money. There's money, you know, pouring through your hands and holes in the department and the agency. So fix that. So this is part of that effort. And what was very surprising to me was who were the people evading fares. You think these are criminals? No, these are everyday folks. You got nurses, you got lawyers, you got folks just going
some
to work. They were in a
mentality
rush.
Mentality that public transit should be free or something, and people
something
just act this way. I don't understand it.
Something was going on. And so, you know, the transit police chief said, look, we're trying to change culture here. And so when you get this summary offense, you got to take off work. You got to go down there and deal with this before. You know, and so they want to change it. They used to give out $25 tickets. That didn't work. People kept doing it. And so they stepped this up and they're having an impact.
Like you said, the context here is we're now past the budget deadline in Harrisburg. Harrisburg has been trying to hash out its budget, which includes this big question about funding for SEPTA. And as you said, anytime there's a big ask in Harrisburg for something related to Philly, the lawmakers there want to see that there's real accountability mm-hmm. with how the money is being spent in Philly. And this seems like the transit authority showing that they are taking that seriously.
They're not playing over there. You got to pay your fares.
Story number three. Mm-hmm. We mentioned yesterday the big news that Philadelphia is getting a WNBA franchise.
Yay!
That's set to begin play in 2030. And time to that, the Inky again has a nice feature on the rise of sports bars in the city that cater to women's athletics. Mm-hmm. So there's Marsh's. It's an establishment that does this. Essentially, it's soon to open at 4th and South, run by a girls high grad. And then there's also this group of fans who go by Watch Party PHL, who are developing what they call a women's sports hub. And there's a Kickstarter campaign led by this Northeast high grad, who's a firefighter, mm-hmm. who is searching for a location in Center City to start a bar focused on women's games. Now, in the meantime, that group is finding like big success hosting watch parties at local bars around the city.
And by the way, I've been following them. They're doing a great job and they have grown their audience of folks to hundreds. It used to be a small group. Now they're bigger and bigger and bigger.
So hopefully these places are thriving by 2030 when the new team is here. And Sherry, the big question then is, like for everybody in the region, what should the name of this new Philly WNBA team be? And I think Studio 2 can be like a hub of this conversation, right? Let's get our listeners involved, our emailers involved. Let's kick around some ideas for like, you know, the short list for you know, influencing the Harris Blitzer ownership group. So, Cherry, I thought maybe you could tell us what are the team names you're kind of feeling right now?
One name that I really, well, I like the OG name that Philly had back in the 90s called the Philadelphia Rage. I love that because
That's
Philly's
mean.
So tough. Yeah. Also, we had a Women's Basketball Development Association league called the Philadelphia Rain, R-E-I-G-N. I love that. And my personal favorite name that I created was Philadelphia Independence.
Ooh, so I actually was going to put that on my short list,
yes.
too.
So
we were
you?
A little
yeah,
bit
yeah.
in length. So I also want to note that there was an old team name called the Philadelphia Fox in
oh.
the Women's Professional Basketball League. I don't
from?
Co-sign that one.
Okay.
I don't know where that came from.
Uh-huh.
I was thinking the Philadelphia Freedom.
That's cool.
Now, there was a tennis team back in the
70s. I feel
70s.
Like I heard a
That
a
was
name
the Billie
with
Jean
freedom.
King
yeah,
team.
Yeah.
But I feel like that could get reinvented and be just kind of like classic, elegant.
Mm-hmm.
I could see that.
Yeah.
Philadelphia Fury.
Yeah, that could be good.
That's kind of like the Rage thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then here's the one that I like, actually. The Philadelphia Ballers.
Uh-oh. I mean, we got to talk about that for a women's team name, but you know what? We could think this thing, let's workshop that a little bit, Kevin McCrory. We're going to workshop that. And the other thing we're going to workshop today is the Big Beautiful Bill. We're going to talk about the political blowback. We have a group coming up that we're going to talk about that with. We'll be right back after the break.
These days, there's so much news. It can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. My co-host Avi Wolfman-Arendt is off this week. President Trump's big, beautiful spending package passed the Senate just moments ago by a margin of 51-50. Democrats were all against it, and there were three Republican holdouts. It's 940 pages long. It's packed with tax breaks, boosts for border security and defense, but also there are cuts to Medicaid and food assistance programs that millions of Americans rely on. Today, we're going to dig into what's in the bill and what it can mean for your wallet, your health care, and more. And we'll start with the health care part of our discussion. Joining us via Zoom is Margot Sanger-Katz, who covers healthcare policy for The Upshot at The New York Times. Margot, thank you so much for being on Studio 2.
My pleasure. It's nice to be here.
And for our listeners, we invite you to join the conversation today. How do you think the president's massive spending bill, which just passed the Senate, will affect you? What impact will it have on the country? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to drop your comments in the live chat. I want to start with a caller. We have Serena from Pennsburg on the line. Serena, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So I'm a Lutheran pastor of a congregation here in Pennsburg, and our local feeding program this summer was shocked to have twice as many children show up this summer as last summer, and certainly a lot more than we expected. And I think people don't realize what the impact of the cuts to food stamps or SNAP and other feeding programs are going to be. It is going to be huge.
Wow.
And the other thing that I would point out is that whenever you raise the deficit significantly, whenever you create more debt, you're not cutting taxes. You are increasing taxes on future generations because somebody's going to have to pay that bill.
Yeah.
So what we gain for what we lose is, I just think, immoral.
Thank you. That's Serena from Pennsburg laying out some of the concerns that people have about this bill. And so, Margot, I mean, we heard there was just a vote. This bill passed. It's going back to the U.S. House. There's a lot of stuff in there. And so I want you to walk us through the big buckets of what's in there. Where's the money going? And where are lawmakers proposing to make the deepest cuts?
So I think it's worth thinking about the bill in kind of three big categories. One is it is a tax cut bill. So the bill is extending tax cuts that were passed by Congress and President Trump in 2017. So most people aren't really going to feel a big change from that. It's sort of just extending the tax cuts that they already got, but that is quite expensive and it's different than what is supposed to happen under current law. There are also some new tax cuts that are part of the bill. Some of them are kind of technical, and some of them are things that President Trump ran on when he ran for re-election, like no tax on certain tips, for example. Then there are some increases in spending to policy priorities of the president, a big increase in spending on immigration enforcement, and a big increase in spending on defense. Then there's the part of the bill where the cuts are. So because both of those first two categories are really expensive, and some members in the House in particular are worried about the federal deficit, they wanted to have some corresponding cuts. The bill does not match, so there's still a very large increase in the deficit and long-term federal debts if this bill becomes law, as the caller noted, but there are these cuts, and they're big cuts to federal health care programs, particularly Medicaid. The bill would cut about $1 trillion from the Medicaid program over the course of a decade. There are also substantial cuts to the Affordable Care Act and to food assistance, student loans, and other categories of federal spending. Sort of folded in with the tax changes, there are big cuts to investments in green energy that were part of the President Biden's agenda in the last term. So that's kind of where the savings part of the bill is coming from, social safety net programs and green energy.
Yeah, and we heard that caller talk a lot about food assistance. But before we get to that topic, I do want to talk about Medicaid, because that could have sweeping impacts. And the CBO is saying about 11 million people plus could possibly lose that benefit. How are those cuts being proposed? Because I understand that it's not a direct cut to a program, but there are still folks who could stand to lose those benefits. How so?
Yeah, the Congress has cut Medicaid in a couple of sort of complicated ways that I think on their face don't sound like cuts, but the result of them is going to be big reductions in spending on Medicaid and in estimates from the Congressional Budget Office and other independent analysts, you know, big decreases in the number of people who are going to be covered by the program. So one thing that the bill would do is it would set up a new work requirement for people who are signed up for Medicaid, but who don't have children and don't have disabilities, or who are the parents of older teenagers, kids over the age of 14. And for those people, in order to get and keep Medicaid, they would need to prove that they are working about 80 hours a month, or that they qualify for a long list of exceptions. And that's a part of the bill that's actually pretty popular if you look at the public polling. But when you talk to folks who really understand how this program works, or who have looked at states that have tried similar policies, what they say is that a lot of people kind of slip through the cracks, because it's really hard to know who's working. It's really hard for people to document that they're working or that they qualify for an exception. So it's just a very big kind of implementation and paperwork challenge. And if people are not aware of the changes, if they don't have the right kind of documents, if they work a kind of job where they don't get a traditional timesheet all the time, if they work a job where they have variable hours, they get more shifts one week than another week, they could end up slipping through the cracks. And there are a lot of exceptions to the work requirement on paper. If you're struggling with a substance abuse problem, you could become exempt. If you're caring for an elderly person who's disabled, you could become exempt. If you were recently hospitalized, you could become exempt. But again, people have to prove this. They would need to come up with some kind of documentation that shows that they qualify for it. They would need to submit it to the state on a regular basis, and some state worker would have to review it and approve it. So I think there is an expectation that a lot of people are going to kind of slip out of Medicaid because of these kinds of requirements. On top of that, they're also just making people sign up more often. So right now, if you enroll in Medicaid, you don't have to renew your coverage for a year. They just kind of assume that if you're not telling us that your circumstances have changed, we're going to assume that you're still eligible. Under this bill, people are going to have to do it twice as often. And so, you know, again, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that on its face. But what we've seen in the past when Medicaid has asked people to renew more often is sometimes people, they moved, you know, the letter doesn't get to the right address, or they're busy, they don't respond quickly, or they don't have the right kind of document and can't respond right away. And so you just see more people kind of cycling in and out of coverage when there are more paperwork requirements.
Yeah, and they couldn't necessarily qualify, but because of the different requirements, they miss something. And I understand the deadlines are tighter as well.
Yeah, well, not so much for Medicaid. That's more on the Obamacare side of the house where the deadlines are getting tighter. But yeah, I mean, I think, of course, with all of these rules, there are some people who are in Medicaid now who technically might not be eligible and or who are not working as the work requirement is designed to catch. And so there are some people who would be ineligible under these rules and who would lose coverage. But I think there are also a larger number of people who technically would be eligible, but just wouldn't be able to prove it well enough or fast enough, might make a mistake. And so that's why you end up with these very large estimated savings and these large estimated reductions in coverage.
So I want to play this clip because President Donald Trump has promised many times during his campaign and in recent talks about the spending bill that he will not cut Medicaid. And here he is addressing the issue again to reporters in May. Take a listen.
We're not touching anything. All I want is one thing, three words. We don't want any waste, fraud, or abuse. Very simple. Waste, fraud, abuse. Other than that, we're leaving it. Medicare, we're leaving it.
And so, Margot, I kind of, you heard the president. He says this, he wants to deal with this whole waste, fraud, and abuse issue. Is there enough waste, fraud, and abuse to get to the numbers that the CBO is estimating? Is there enough waste and fraud to really make deep cuts in Medicaid? And will this, you know, these cuts be a vast overreach?
I think it really depends. I mean, those are subjective terms. Like, what does it mean to be abuse? What does it mean to be waste? I think there is not a lot of fraud in Medicaid, and I don't think that these provisions are really getting at the fraud that may exist in the program. Currently, people who do not meet work requirements are allowed to be in Medicaid. The current law says that if your income is below a certain threshold, you are eligible for Medicaid if you're in a state that expanded the program. So they're changing who's becoming eligible and then saying if they don't meet this new standard, they were doing something that was potentially fraudulent before. So I think it is an exaggeration. They are really changing the rules. They're changing who qualifies. And I think, you know, that's fine. I think if they want to change who qualifies, they can do that. But I think that they are representing it as fixing abuses that are not currently abuses under the law. There is another big category of Medicaid cuts in this bill that we haven't talked about, and that I think also there is some subjective debate about whether or not they represent waste, fraud, or abuse. The bill also cuts funding to a lot of states to support their programs if they finance them using this kind of convoluted financing mechanism that's sometimes called Medicaid provider taxes. This is pretty complicated, but I think the short way of understanding it is it's a technique that states use to get the federal government to pay a larger share of Medicaid's bills. A lot of people have criticized it for a very long time, but it's been legal since the 1990s, and 49 of the 50 states have this mechanism in place to fund its Medicaid program. The bill would prevent states from increasing their use of this mechanism, and they would cause a lot of states that have higher rates of usage to reduce the amount that they can get from the federal government this way. So I think this change is more of a straightforward cut to state funding of Medicaid, and the states that are affected by it are going to have to figure out how to support all of the Medicaid beneficiaries that they cover with fewer federal resources. I think that's going to lead to some real issues in state budgets and some real potential changes either to Medicaid itself or to other parts of the state budget, as long as state legislators start to figure out how are we going to fill this rather large budgetary hole.
And in Pennsylvania right now, a big sticking point in Pennsylvania is the Medicaid spending in the state, and they've been asked for billions more to help fill a hole. And so I want to bring in a guest. We have joining us now is Colleen Tomko from Bucks County. Her son Sean has developmental disabilities and received Medicaid services. She has some concerns about the cuts and changes to the bill. Colleen, you're on Studio 2. Welcome.
Hi. Oh, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So, Colleen, I want you to sort of tell us a little bit about your story briefly, but then also share what concerns you have after hearing what Margot was talking about with regard to all the cuts that could be coming.
Well, Sean is now 35 years old, and he's already been waiting on wait list. He couldn't get in the waiver he wants because there's already massive waiting list, and even if you get in a waiver, you get in one that's underserving you. So Medicaid is already, we've been protesting and going to stuff and contacting our legislators for probably 20 some years. And you know, everybody seems to know him. He's got very significant needs. He's nonverbal, but he's able to go to work, because Medicaid supports him and has a staff person. He volunteers at the library. He actually works at the front desk at PBS as a volunteer too. So he has a life that is enriched to him, and he enjoys it, and he's contributing. So yeah. Medicaid gives him that life.
Yeah.
We cannot plan for his future because there's not enough funding to plan to make sure that he has those services continued and that people can do what we do for him at home when we're not able to do that. So my concern is that there's not enough dollars already, and they're cutting it. And the biggest concern is that Medicaid, the home and community-based services are optional. And historically, every time there's been any cuts to Medicaid, those are the things that all states have cut.
Yeah. And let me ask you a quick follow-up before I let you go, Colleen. I mean, we've been talking about some of the reporting requirements that are going to be now included. Do those raise any concerns for you as someone with a son who needs Medicaid?
Yeah, like I said, because he works some, so on paper, you know, he's going to appear as somebody that can work. And he's at the mercy of us filling out the paperwork for him. And if we don't do that, I don't know what's going to happen to his Medicaid coverage and supports.
Yeah. Thank you so much. That is Colleen Tomko from Bucks County. Her son, Sean, has received Medicaid services. And so, Margo, I want you to react to that. I mean, how do you see this ripple effect sort of? Because in Pennsylvania, we have 300,000 people that stand to lose Medicaid under this spending bill. And your thoughts as to how it could have a real ripple effect on these families across the country?
So I think it's important to say that the bill is not directly cutting any services or any particular funding for people with disabilities or people who need home and community-based care. The biggest changes are really targeted at these kind of childless, non-disabled adults. But I think there are two ways that you could see the reforms in this bill really rippling out and affecting populations like Colleen and her son. One is, as I said, I think they are through these reforms of these funding mechanisms, reducing funding to the states. The states are going to face difficult choices. You know, I don't know what the state of Pennsylvania will do. They could raise taxes. Mm-hmm. They could cut other things they do, like education. But I think probably the first thing that they're going to do is they're going to look to see, is there a way we can save money in our Medicaid program? And as Colleen said, one of the options that they have is they can stop paying for home and community-based care for people who have long-term care needs. I don't think that's necessarily the policy preference of a lot of lawmakers, but we have seen in the past that's kind of a lever that they can pull when they encounter a budget emergency. The other problem, and you know, this is a more technical one, is that implementing this work requirement is actually kind of hard for states to do. They're going to have to build very complex new computer systems that help them figure out who's subject to this work requirement. How are we going to count these different exceptions? How are people going to be able to upload documents? Who's going to check them? Lots of people are going to have questions. States are going to have to build out call centers to answer those questions. They're going to have staff who are trained in the physical offices if people come in and have questions. And if there are problems with that, if there are difficulties with that, it does sort of pull resources away from other parts of the Medicaid program. And God forbid, if there was any kind of technical snafu where the enrollment system got broken as a result of those changes, that also could really affect other kinds of Medicaid patients who are trying to sign up for coverage. Not the direct target of the work requirements, but we did hear from a number of experts in building these systems who said, this is going to be a heavy lift for states.
Yeah, yeah.
The law does not give them a ton of time to do it. And there is the possibility of things kind of breaking and that breakage affecting other beneficiaries of the program.
Yeah, let me read a couple comments. We have David on YouTube who says, while it aims to stimulate economic growth, critics warn it could balloon the national debt and deepen income inequality. Elections have consequences, says David. Judy says the tax cuts help people who already have more than enough. And Lou says, my doctor says that many of his colleagues aren't happy with the uncertainty around health care. We are already short on docs. It looks like it will get worse. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. Our question of the day is, how do you think the president's spending bill, which just passed the Senate this hour, will affect you? What impact will it have on the country? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, keep those comments coming. I want to bring in another caller. We have Suzanne from Germantown on the line. Suzanne, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
I'm very curious to see how the Republican-dominated states and even within Pennsylvania, the Republican voters that voted for Trump. It'll be interesting to see how that whole thing will be navigated, whether there'll be, in some states, it'll be less invasive cuts, or whether they're going to be, truly reflect all the
I think I understand what Suzanne, thank you, that's Suzanne from Germantown. She wonders whether red states will be affected in the same way that blue states are affected by this bill. Margo, any thoughts on that? Is the ripple effect, the impact of the bill going to be felt evenly across the country?
I think that it will not be perfectly evenly felt across the country, but I do think that there are a lot of red states who could be really disadvantaged by this bill. There are a number of red states that have expanded Medicaid and that have quite large poor populations. There are a lot of red states that have a lot of rural areas, and I do think that these changes to Medicaid funding could be particularly challenging for rural hospitals. And if rural hospitals close, that affects not just people on Medicaid, but other people who live in those areas. So I think there are certain ways in which certain red states and certain policies are protected. But I would say overall, these are very large cuts to big programs that affect people in every state. And I think the red states are not going to be immune from those effects.
Yeah. Got to ask you about food assistance, because new work reporting requirements could cut SNAP benefits by up to $300 billion, moving millions from food support. I want you to talk about the impact that you see there. And we heard one of our first callers talk about she's already seeing that at food pantries and the impact felt across the country and has a lot of concerns there.
Yeah, these are also pretty large reductions in federal spending on the food stamp program, sometimes called the SNAP program. But this is like the biggest nutrition assistance program in the country. They're making a bunch of changes. They're changing the formula for how much people get. They are stiffening up some work requirements. That means that more people are going to have to prove that they're working in order to get food assistance, including for the first time, people older than 55. And, you know, some advocates have pointed out that there are a lot of early retirees in this population. They're not intending to be working, but they benefit from food assistance and they could lose it. And then the third thing is, this is another shift to state budgets. For the first time, this bill would ask states to sort of put up a share of the cost of the food assistance program. And if there is a high error rate in the state's processing of claims, they could ratchet up how much the state would have to pay. And so that's another increased funding burden on states. State budgets are going to have to figure out how to absorb that additional cost. And different states are going to make different decisions about how they're going to deal with that.
And we're all in budget talks right now. As we get ready to wrap up with you, Margo, just sort of, what are you looking at? Because this Senate bill just passed 51-50, tiebreaker by the vice president. It's going back to the House. What will you be looking at to see whether or not this agenda will be rolled out to the American people?
I think it's really a question of what the House is going to do. The House has obviously already passed an earlier version of this bill, but the Senate made a lot of changes. And many of the changes that they made are changes that members of the House said that they would not support the first time around. So, you know, President Trump has a lot of power over the Republican Party. I think this is a very large priority, this bill, both for him and for leaders in both the House and the Senate. But it's certainly not over yet. And there are members of the House who have concerns about the bill, either feeling that the Medicaid and food cuts are too severe, or on the other side, really worrying about the long-term fiscal impact of the bill, because it would increase the deficit and federal debt by so much. They might actually be looking for more cuts, and trying to figure out how to sort of navigate the shoals between those two groups of lawmakers could be tricky.
Well, thank you so much, Margo Sanger Katz, who covers healthcare policy for The Upshot at The New York Times, has been with us. Thank you for helping us get a better understanding of what's in the bill. Thank you for being on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we'll continue this conversation. Join the conversation by calling 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg. We are discussing the GOP tax and spending bill that just passed the Senate, 51-50, with Vice President J.D. Vance casting the deciding vote. Now the battle will continue in the U.S. House. And joining us to talk about the legislation and what's next for the big, beautiful bill are two political commentators. We have Will Bunch, a national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Will, welcome back to Studio 2.
Yeah, hi, Cherry. Thanks for having me back.
We also have Guy Shiraki, a senior fellow with the Commonwealth Foundation. Guy, thanks so much for being here again.
Good afternoon. Glad to be back.
And as a reminder, we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. Our question of the day is, how do you think the president's spending bill, which just passed the Senate, will affect you? What impact will it have on our country? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop those comments in the live chat. And so, Will and Guy, I want to get your take. Before we dig into the nitty gritty, I want you to get your take on this big, beautiful bill. Will, we'll start with you. What's your thoughts? It just passed the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, I mean, it's very exciting to, you know, between the time I was booked to go on this show at the last minute and the time I actually came on, the bill passed, which, you know, it was kind of shocking the speed with which this happened, you know, and, you know, for all the talk for days about the concerns that some of these Republican potential holdouts might have about either the steep cuts to Medicaid and the SNAP program and other things being cut, you know, in the end, they got it done very quickly and very efficiently. And it's just what we've seen again and again with this Republican Congress under Trump that, you know, fealty to their leader, Trump's, pun intended, just about everything else, you know, any political concerns. I'll just add quickly before Guy, I mean, this bill is wildly unpopular. You know, polls show as little as 30% of the American people are supporting this bill, and yet they felt compelled to pass it anyway. And I think that just shows the kind of political pressure that's put on these Republican lawmakers.
And Guy, I want to get your thoughts, and you can feel free to respond to Will there. What is your take on the bill? And I understand you would have voted for it.
So it's an important bill. It's important that it move forward and become law. It is imperfect. You know, as I often joke, the next piece of perfect legislation that Congress passes will be its first in history. Look, if for no other reason, the tax cuts that were put in place during the first Trump administration have to be made permanent. The last thing we need coming out of a weak economy with high inflation is for anyone, working families, farmers, small businesses, or job creators to suddenly have to have an enormous tax hike. So if for no other reason, making sure that the tax cuts that helped create a stronger economy remain in place. We don't need to raise anybody's taxes coming out of the economy we just had. And second, look, there are a lot of things that are good. There are a lot of things that are bad. I'll highlight one that hasn't been played much. Pennsylvania has an education tax credit program. We encourage people to donate to scholarship organizations to help poor and working class families. It's been so successful in Pennsylvania, there's almost as many as families turned down as actually get it. Groups like Blocks or the Children's Scholarship Fund help thousands of children each year. We'll now have a federal component. So folks like your listeners and me and Will and you, Cherry, can donate to scholarship organizations to help poor and working class families find a school that works.
Yeah.
So there's, look, it's imperfect, but it will keep more money in pockets and encourage people to contribute in their local communities. It's an imperfect bill, but it needs to become law.
And I want to play this clip because in a fiery speech yesterday, Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina said the existing Senate version of the Big Beautiful Bill will break President Trump's promise not to cut Medicaid. I wanted you to hear what he had to say.
Now, Republicans are about to make a mistake on health care and betraying a promise. It is inescapable that this bill in its current form will betray the very promise that Donald J. Trump made.
And so, Guy, I want you to respond to that because we spent the first part of this hour talking about some of the reverberations that were going to happen and the millions of people that could stand to lose Medicaid, including possibly $300,000 in Pennsylvania. And you said this bill is imperfect. I mean, Why is that something that you think people should be willing to allow happen? Was that enough to sort of, Tom Tillis stood up, said no. That's part of the imperfections. Were you okay with that part?
So a few things. At 3 o'clock in the morning with no sleep, a lot of people temper get, you know, so I would take it all with a grain of salt. And Senator Tillis and President Trump probably aren't going to be golfing together anytime in the near future. But as to the substance, here's the reality. The federal budget, the federal government will spend more money on Medicaid next year than it did this year. What we're fighting about is the size and the speed of the growth. More money will be spent next year. More money will be spent the following year. What we're fighting over is the speed of the growth. And the one of the ways to slow the growth is to make sure that it goes to the people who deserve it. The reality is the recipients, the people who truly deserve Medicaid, will actually have more dollars per person spent on them. Anyone removed is removed either because there was an abuse of the system or because they're single and able-bodied. No mom, no child will go without medical coverage. They will have more money available to them. In essence, this is an attempt for President Trump and the Republicans to put it back into place what had been the Bill Clinton standard, which was the standard that was bipartisan. We're going to spend more money next year, and we're putting the Clinton rules back in place. It seems to be a common sense compromise.
But aren't there some people who would just have more that could have been the ones who made the sacrifice to try to make this a more balanced bill? I mean, there's going to be $3.3 trillion added to the federal deficit over the next decade. That is not coming down with even with these cuts.
And the majority of these tax cuts, when Guy talks about the importance of extending the tax cuts for everyone, when this bill was passed in 2017 or 18, very few benefits went to the middle class. The vast bulk of the benefits of these tax cuts go to billionaires, millionaires, big corporations, and that's what they voted to continue here. And it manages to both increase the deficit, but yet they still felt they had to make some cuts somewhere to pay for some of this. And there's just not that many places for everything you hear about waste, fraud, and abuse. There's really just not that many places to cut in the federal budget. And they went after Medicaid. And, people, working families, working class, blue collar families are going to be hurt by these cuts. It's not just going to be fraudulent people on Medicaid. A lot of people who are living from paycheck to paycheck are going to now also lose their health coverage. So it's really a disastrous bill.
And by the way, there
will be more money spent next year than this year. That's a fact. There was more money spent next year. We're fighting over the rate of growth. The growth is not going as fast as some people would like. More money will be spent next year. No one, in fact, people who are legitimately covered will have more money spent on that. I wish we could have an honest discussion. If we truly want to close the deficit gap, let's agree what is a cut and what is a slowing down in the rate of growth.
And Guy and Will, I want to hear your thoughts on this as well. I mean, how are the Republicans going to sell this to the American people, especially when you have a large MAGA base that are very blue collar, that are very working class, many of which do rely on Medicaid because they don't have a lot of money? What are the talking points that Republicans are going to use once these folks start falling off of this public benefit? What are the talking points? And then the counter, Will, what are the Democrats going to use to counter this? Are they setting themselves up for a big loss next year? Will, your thoughts, how are they going to sell this?
Well, I think the Republicans are going to have a hard time selling this because, a lot of the success of the Republican Party, in the last few years has been tied to their building a right-wing media infrastructure, right? So, voters respond a lot more often to what they're hearing on a place like Fox News or on Newsmax than what they are maybe experiencing in real life. They're seeing, immigrant caravans coming through Mexico or whatever. But these cuts are so broad that it's hard to imagine most families won't feel some impact from this. Whether it's Medicaid, whether it's SNAP, whether it's Medicare, Obamacare is going to be harder to apply for and people are not going to have it. Every family is going to be touched by this. And I think it's going to be really hard for a Republican in a swing district or a district that Kamala Harris won in 2024 to go out there and convince voters. I don't think Democrats can just rest on that. I think Democrats have to put together a positive program. I mean, they can look at some of the affordability issues that Zohran Mamdani in New York was able to use so successfully and try and make a more nationwide, more palatable version of that. But it's going to be tough for the GOP to sell this, incredibly unpopular bill.
Yeah. And by the way, House Republican leadership has put out a statement today, just now, saying that they intend to get the bill on the president's desk by July 4th. And so, Guy, your thoughts, how are they going to sell this? I mean, clearly, you know, the House Speaker is going to whip his folks into shape. They're going to get this done. But then they have to still face the American people.
Sure. President Trump's approval rating at this point in his administration is about 10 points higher than it was in his first term, whereas the Democratic Party's approval for Democrats in Congress is around 20%. So from the politics of it, President Trump goes to the American public in an exponentially more popular and stronger hand than the Democrats. The Democrats have a credibility gap where most folks don't think that they're engaged on real issues. So the president has an opportunity to use that popularity and use the bully pulpit he uses so well with the media and social media to explain the truth, just much like the debate Will and I are having with you, Cherry. And I don't know, Will, I listen to WHYY a lot, so I don't know about but look, I think it's by...
I listen to WPHT a lot also, so we all try and broaden our exposure.
So I think they do it by talking about the facts, which is the importance of the tax cuts, and we get out the truth on Medicaid that it really wasn't a cut. And, last, I'll say sort of tongue-in-cheek, if Will thinks sending out Mr. Mamdani around the nation to help sell the Democrats' position, I'll pay for his bus fare. He doesn't need free bus fare. I'll pay for it if he's going to be the spokesperson of what
they don't need to send him, and they probably won't. But they do need to talk about some of the things he talked about: high rents, affordable transit, things like that. The young voters are craving for those solutions.
And by the way, I want to shift gears a little bit before, because we only have about 4 or 5 minutes left in the show. But, you know, Elon Musk has slammed this bill, says he'll create the new American Party, a third political party, to take on Republicans and Democrats. He also has vowed to primary Republicans who back it, despite his recent ties to the president and to the GOP. I mean, do you see this as a threat? Someone who was in the inner sanctum of the Trump administration, now very vocal about this. By the way, we're showing his tweet if you're watching on YouTube. He says, every member of Congress who campaigned on reducing government spending and then immediately voted for the biggest debt increase in history should hang their head in shame, and they will lose their primary next year if it is the last thing I do on this earth. Of course, the president has clapped back, threatening to end subsidies to Musk and his companies. But I mean, I think about this because I know, Guy, you're a fiscal conservative. You look at bottom lines. This bill will increase the national debt. Bottom line, it's not a savings bill. So, you know, even if, how can Republicans back this when they know that their grandchildren will be paying this, and that the people that they say that they represent will be hit so hard? And we'll wrap this up with that.
Sure. So my mom always told me, when elephants fight, get out of the way. So I'm not going to get into Trump versus Musk. I think they're both going to come to the realization that their coalition needs both of them. And the sooner they recognize that, the better. Second, I disagree with some of the numbers coming out of the Congressional Budget Office. The Congressional Budget Office historically doesn't like Republican budgets. They historically don't appreciate the growing impact of tax cuts, and they exaggerate the tax loss. Whereas from President Kennedy to President Reagan to President Trump, tax cuts ultimately bring about growth. So look, I think we need to have a serious discussion about slowing the rate of growth and fixing it. I think this bill is a step in that right direction, but I would respectfully point out to the discussion we're having, if we can't discuss slowing the rate of growth of programs, how are we ever going to discuss cutting or eliminating these programs? This needs to become a bipartisan issue. The way to solve this problem is make it a bipartisan issue and be serious. we need to slow the rate of growth and ultimately hold the rate of growth of government and let the economy grow naturally and stop focusing on taxes and stop demagoguing every time we slow the rate of growth. It is a problem. This bill helps it, not as much as I would like. This bill helps it. The economy would be better. People will be better off for it. And then let's find a bipartisan way to tackle the real problem so that it's not left versus right. It's in everybody's interest to get it under control.
Yeah, and I'll give you the final word. You have about 40 seconds.
Well, I'll just say about Elon Musk. I mean, Elon Musk is about the only thing in America that's more unpopular than the big, beautiful bill right now. So I don't think any third party that he starts would have a chance. But I will say this. I mean, I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction out there in both parties. I'm seeing it among Democrats who would like to see the party take a different direction. I don't think there's a lot of support for a third party, but I do think you could see at least the Democratic Party and maybe post-Trump, the Republican Party, look a lot different than what they look like right now. That's the environment. People are very dissatisfied right now.
And we'll have to leave it right there. By the way, quick update, as we said before, Republican leadership plans to move the bill through the House quickly. The House committee that prepares legislation for the floor will meet in a half hour. That's how quickly they're trying to make this move. So I want to say thank you so much to Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and to Guy Shiraki, a senior fellow with the Commonwealth Foundation. Thanks to you both for being on Studio 2.
Thank you so much, Sherry.
Thanks, Will. Thanks, Guy. Thanks, Sherry.
Thank you. And by the way, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you tomorrow at noon for more Studio 2.